This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Coastal cities around the world are going to be facing tremendous challenges in the coming century. And of course, the challenges are going to be unevenly distributed, and there's going to be a major equity and justice issue about which communities and which cities are able to afford the kinds of protection measures that will allow them to adapt to climate.
As they learn more about the realities of climate change and sea level rise, some coastal communities are taking action. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Benjamin Grant, the Urban Design Policy Director for SPUR, a California-based nonprofit that focuses on making urban areas more sustainable. In response to already documented rapid erosion, Grant and his colleagues have presented San Francisco with a bold plan for redoing a 3.5-mile stretch of San Francisco's coast, known as Ocean Beach. We talk about the San Francisco proposal and how it could serve as a template for other coastal cities, if they can afford it, that is. I'm joined now by Benjamin Grant. He's the Urban Design Policy Director for SPUR. Ben, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
So first, why don't you tell our listeners about SPUR real quickly?
Well, SPUR is a 100-year-old civic organization. It's a policy think tank and advocacy organization. We do original research, education, and advocacy on cities, city planning, and related disciplines, including sustainability, transportation, housing, etc.
And is it regional?
We've historically been based in San Francisco, but in the last few years, we have opened offices in San Jose and Oakland with the idea of working at the local level in the three largest cities of the Bay Area. So many of our decisions about planning are made at the local level, and yet they have regional implications, whether it's transportation or air quality or environmental protection. So that's how we're choosing to tackle regional issues, is through those three cities.
And you've been looking specifically for the last few years, doing a lot of research into what it will take to plan ahead for sea level rise. Why don't you take us to the genesis of this very large undertaking?
Sure. Well, as we've come to realize what we're facing in terms of climate change, of course, a huge area of policy effort is to mitigate climate change, which is to say to keep climate change from happening to the degree that we can. And that means decarbonizing our infrastructure, our transportation systems, creating a renewable energy system for our entire society, which is a huge undertaking. But one thing we've come to realize is that even if we all cleaned up our act tomorrow and we never drove again and we never got on an airplane again, we have already locked in quite significant changes to the climate system, changes that we're going to have to live with for the coming decades and indeed centuries. So, and we, you know, have not solved the emissions side, so things are likely to continue to worsen for a time to come. So we're certainly not giving up on the mitigation side, but a major new area of planning and policy research is in what we call climate adaptation. How do we come to terms with and adapt to the changes that we've already locked in?
And in a city environment, that's very much inextricably linked with urban planning on a scale that we haven't really seen since the advent of the automobile.
Absolutely. Cities, the good news is that cities represent an amazing piece of human and social and economic technology that allow human beings to live in a much more efficient way. So the average urban dweller has a fraction of the carbon emissions of somebody that lives in a suburban or rural environment, simply because of what we call access by proximity. The most important feature of this is transportation. If you can walk where you're going because you live in a denser, more compact environment, there's a mix of activities nearby so that you can do your living, working, playing, shopping within either a walking distance or distances that are bridged by transportation. Public transportation, cycling, and so forth. It's simply a much, much more efficient settlement pattern. So So in city planning, a huge thrust of our work in the past several decades and certainly into the future is to really try to retool cities to make them as efficient as we can, to also make cities a better and more attractive alternative for more people. I mean, for generations, especially in the United States, we were really all about leaving our cities and abandoning our cities. And that was really the story of the 20th century. And the good news is that that pattern has really done a 180-degree shift. Increasingly, people are attracted to the amenities, the efficiencies, the lifestyles that cities have to offer. That comes with it, brings with it a big array of challenges in terms of accommodating the people that want to move back into our cities, thinking about how we grow urban places adequately to prevent people from being displaced, and to create new urban neighborhoods that allow people to access those lifestyles, those efficiencies, and those choices, which we haven't done. We essentially stopped building walkable neighborhoods between the 1930s and, you know, the mid-90s, probably. And we've only just started the project of retooling not only our center cities, but also our suburban environments that were built around the car, where people really don't have those choices. So, you know, a lot of Spur's work at the in the Bay Area region is thinking about how do we look at the large swaths of our region that were built around the car, and how do we start to gradually retrofit that to create the kinds of neighborhoods where people have those choices, where they can walk, where they can use public transit, where they can bike, and also protect our regional open space and agriculture, really turn back the pattern of sprawling suburban development that we engaged in for the 20th century. That's just not going to work anymore. And we need to start thinking much more intelligently about our lifestyles and how our planning and transportation choices affect the way people live and what their impact is on the climate.
So you've been working, you and your colleagues have been working to protect Ocean Beach and to plan for sea level rise. Why don't you first tell our listeners what Ocean Beach is?
Ocean Beach is a 3.5-mile sandy beach on the western edge of San Francisco. It's the open Pacific coast. It's a beautiful, rugged landscape. It's often foggy and windy. Sometimes it has glorious weather, and it's really, in some ways, the city's most welcoming beach. On those rare hot days in San Francisco, people flock there. But every day, people are there using it. It's a very popular surfing spot. It's actually famous and has hosted international competitions. It's also a national park. It's part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, and is a link between some of the other major components of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, including Land's End and Fort Funston. And it also connects to a lot of city parks like Golden Gate Park, the San Francisco Zoo, and Lake Merced. So it's a very important open space for the city of San Francisco. Now, the reason that we got involved at Ocean Beach is because there's a serious ongoing erosion problem, particularly at the south end of Ocean Beach. So the coast in that area gets hammered by winter storms.
This is out by the zoo.
Exactly, at the south end of the beach in the vicinity of Sloat Boulevard. That area gets hammered by winter storms. In El Nino winters, where we have especially rainy and stormy winters, those erosion episodes can become quite severe. In 2010, we had an El Nino year that resulted in 40 feet of recession of the bluffs in some locations in that area, 40 feet in a single season. And there's not much space down there to work with. Very close to the coastal beach and bluffs are parking lots for accessing the beach, the Great Highway, which is a significant north-south roadway. And then behind that is both the zoo and the Oceanside Water Pollution Control Plant, which is a large sewage treatment plant. That plant and some of the associated wastewater infrastructure was built in the 1980s, only completed in 1993, and has done an amazing job of protecting coastal water quality. That whole complex was built to bring San Francisco into compliance with the Clean Water Act, because in San Francisco, we have a combined sewer and stormwater system, which means the storm drain on your street goes into the same place as your toilet and your sink. The advantage of that is that we are able to treat
our stormwater, which is a significant source of what we call non-point source pollution. The downside of that is that in extreme wet weather conditions, the system can become overwhelmed and you have discharges of wastewater that has not been fully treated into coastal waters or waters on the bayside as well. So that used to happen in San Francisco pretty much every time it rained. And a sustained series of investments in this kind of infrastructure has managed to reduce the number of discharges by a factor of 90%.
When you say used to, how long ago are we talking?
So before the Clean Water Program that built that system, which the Clean Water Act passed in the early 70s, that system was planned and built through the 70s and 80s and opened in 1993. That is only for the west side of the city. So the natural watersheds of San Francisco, if you know the city, drains westward from Twin Peaks and Mount Davidson, and all of those western neighborhoods drain towards the ocean into this as part of that watershed. And this system is designed to be gravity fed through that watershed and the storm drains and then feed into that system. So that represents a significant success story in terms of protecting water quality. The problem is that this infrastructure is immediately adjacent to the coast, and it's there for a reason because that's where the gravity wants to drain the water to. But immediately under the Great Highway is a major transport and storage pipe called the Lake Merced Tunnel. And that pipe is threatened by this coastal erosion. So we have a solution to a previous environmental problem that is now exposed to a current environmental problem.
Cleaning all the windows, singing songs about it at PF Soul. And I hear blue strains of no regret on across the street from Cathedral Notre Dame. Meanwhile, back in San Francisco, trying hard to make this whole thing blend. Yet the city pond is jagged, story block with you, my friend. And it's a long way.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Ben Grant. He is the Urban Design Policy Director for SPUR. What barometers did you use? Whose reports did you refer to when you were trying to calculate what you needed to do to build a sustainable coastline in terms of sea level rise?
Yeah, one of the challenges of planning for climate change is we don't know exactly what climate change is going to look like. We have a pretty good idea of the ranges, and the science is getting better and better. In San Francisco, we have the luxury of not having to engage the conversation about whether climate change is real. But that doesn't mean there's not a lot of uncertainty in the range and extent and pace of changes that will come. We're already facing the effects of coastal erosion at Ocean Beach. So the debate over exactly how fast seas are going to rise is not as pertinent to this planning process.
Oh, because of the erosion.
That's right. The erosion is already happening. Now, we know that erosion is going to get significantly worse, and exactly the pace of change that will drive that is still part of the debate in terms of the science. But we do have a lot of work being done at the state level and at the city level to essentially try to select parameters from the best science to guide policymakers. Because if everybody's reading a different study or picking a different number in the range of future changes, how do we plan in a consistent and unified way? So when we started, we used the state's interim guidance on climate change, which was the prevailing document at that time. And there have been several subsequent policy statements at the state level, as well as a process at the city level to bring all the city agencies together to select the science that is the best guess for how seas will rise, how precipitation will change. The research continues to come in, but if you think about the kinds of technical agencies that have to work on these things, you have the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission that is dealing with both water supply and sewer and wastewater. If you're dealing with wastewater, that means you have pipes that are where the treated effluent comes out from sewage treatment. Those open into the bay and into the ocean. So it's very important to understand how sea level rise will affect our shorelines, how that system is going to work. Most of it's gravity fed. They also have to manage the city's stormwater. That is, when it rains, the runoff. And that is going to be affected by climate change in terms of changes in precipitation. And that in California, that's actually less well understood, is how climate change will affect precipitation, because there are factors that are pushing in both directions, at least in the coastal area. We'll almost certainly see a lot less snowpack in the Sierra, which is a major concern in terms of the drought we're already 3 years into and may continue for some time to come.
And with home values continuing to soar here in San Francisco, Ben, I can't imagine how thorny this issue of a major overhaul of the coastline might become.
Absolutely. I mean, in San Francisco, we have a very passionate and engaged citizenry, and that has its pluses and minuses, frankly. You know, making decisions in a democracy is always messy. And planning for the future, especially in an area with a lot of complicated technical issues, can be very tricky. But we came into the issue at Ocean Beach at a time when there was already a great deal of frustration and controversy. The city had been responding to the erosion by placing boulders on the beach, putting riprap boulders, revetments we call them, to protect the infrastructure on a kind of emergency basis.
So it was kind of a stopgap measure.
That's right. And it was never intended to be permanent. On the other hand, it's pretty tricky to remove a huge pile of 2-ton boulders. There was a lot of frustration on the part of environmentalists and on the part of surfers who use that part of the beach that this kind of coastal armoring not only degrades the beach by covering it up and being unattractive, but it also results in secondary scour, where the waves kind of bounce off of the armoring and scour the sand away, and it actually can exacerbate beach erosion. So you might be solving the issue for the moment in that sort of acute location, but it's not really a long-term strategy. And when we came in, the tenor of the discussion was really sort of, which side are you on? Are you for coastal armoring, or are you for managed retreat, which is the process of stepping back away from the coast and letting nature take its course? And we really came to believe that it can't be an either-or proposition. This is a very constrained space. This is a place that has a lot of different uses and a lot of different needs, whether it's habitat, beach access, this infrastructure system that's protecting coastal water quality, and then circulation and traffic. All of these things have to be figured out in a very small space. And we worked very hard through a series of public workshops to help everybody understand what each other's needs were, and understand that nobody was going to get everything that they wanted out of this, but that we could do a lot better than the kind of stalemate that we had ended up in.
It's also important to remember that this is going to outlive most of these people. This plan is trying to project how Ocean Beach will look in 2100.
Absolutely. We really are trying to take the long view here. And that was a really important aspect of this for us. We did coastal modeling with coastal engineers to look at how the coastline would respond out to the year 2100 under different kinds of management approaches, whether it was just hold the line and protect the existing infrastructure with the minimum cost, or whether it was, you know, full on managed retreat, get rid of the road, start to disassemble the infrastructure, even look at the zoo and the treatment plant. None of those were really proposals. They were more like thought experiments to help people understand where the trade-offs reside. And this is not uncommon in city planning to think about scenarios, different ways of approaching a problem, and to look at how they would play out over the long haul. And through this process, we were able to get from that sort of either or which side are you on framework to get a pretty broad-based buy-in for what we call a yes and plan, that it's going to include significant managed retreat. And in fact, we're talking about gradually closing down a portion of that coastal road. Also, beach nourishment, which is the placement of sand, and we're on the beach, and we're very lucky in San Francisco in that we have a ready supply of clean sand that's already being dredged from a shipping channel that allows ships to get in and out of the Golden Gate and can be placed on the beach. And then also some very carefully targeted coastal armoring in the right places, designed to be minimally invasive in terms of the coastal dynamic movement and the habitat value of the beach.
But different than bouldering, correct?
Absolutely.
What kind of armoring are we talking about?
We're talking about sort of a what we call a low-profile structural protection measure, which is installed from above. So instead of ripping up the whole beach and building a seawall, you're drilling down from the road well behind where the bluffs are today and sort of injecting some concrete reinforcement that wouldn't even be visible. And then once you've done that, you can go in and remove those boulder revetments, open up the beach, and actually do ecological restoration of the surface. And then install a coastal trail that becomes an open space amenity. So this kind of using a problem, this pressure of erosion that we know is going to get worse, and thinking of it as a placemaking opportunity. How can we get the best possible outcome in this place that serves all the different needs that's required? And that's kind of the plan that we've come to.
Of the things I planned to do, I only did halfway. Tomorrow will be Sunday, born of rain, Saturday. There's some satisfaction in the San Francisco rain. No matter what comes down, the mission always looks the same.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Ben Grant. He's the Urban Design Policy Director at SPUR, which is a nonprofit organization. So, Ben, what templates did SPUR look towards when they were putting together this Ocean Beach Master Plan? Was it Amsterdam? Give us some examples of cities that you think are planning for sea level rise correctly.
Sure. Well, climate adaptation and coastal planning is in many ways quite new, at least in the context of sea level rise and thinking about how we plan for a gradual change that we know is coming, which doesn't mean there aren't great examples that we can look to around the world, including actually in California. Surfers Point in Ventura is a place where they were able to remove a bunch of coastal armoring and let the coast erode naturally and do a bunch of restoration at the mouth of the Ventura River. So that sort of got that managed retreat idea. The Dutch, of course, famously have been managing their coastline for centuries. Some people worry that that's sort of too intrusive an approach, right? That there's you're essentially creating an artificial coastline and holding it with engineered dikes and levees and so forth. So we're certainly sensitive to that, although actually the Dutch have become global innovators in more ecologically sensitive coastal management as well. But there's a lot of very interesting work that they have done on their coastline. One example is something that's called the Sand Engine, which is a place near Rotterdam in Holland where they have placed huge quantities of sand, but instead of placing it at the location where they're trying to deal with an erosion issue on the beach, they're placing it at the beginning of that coastal sediment system and letting the natural processes carry that sand through the system. So they're really maximizing their retention of the natural sediment process that makes beaches work. Beaches really are very much dynamic places. It's not a fixed thing. There's a coastal sediment system, and the beach is really the tip of an iceberg that we see, but it relates to a much more complex system of how sand and sediment moves. And that Dutch example is one where they are looking at that dynamic system and understanding where they can feed it instead of trying to place it in a fixed endpoint and hope it doesn't wash away. It always washes away. That's how beaches are.
One of the things that we have to remember also is that we're talking about some of the most highly developed cities and countries that are embarking on these very expensive projects. There are countless other cities and areas around the globe that are not going to be afforded this kind of luxury of moving earth and sand to meet the needs of its population.
Absolutely. Coastal cities around the world are going to be facing tremendous challenges in the coming century. And of course, as with all policy challenges, the challenges are going to be unevenly distributed, and there's going to be a major equity and justice issue about which communities and which cities are able to afford the kinds of protection measures that will allow them to adapt to climate. And we need to be thinking very seriously about how we apportion resources over time. It's very easy to think, okay, you know, downtown San Francisco, lower Manhattan, Amsterdam, Venice, which has already embarked on a major...
Miami, New Orleans.
Yeah, these places are likely to be able to have those resources and are, you know, represent tremendous cultural heritage and historic value and are part of the developed world where the resources are there to do this. If you're talking about Bangladesh or other coastal cities in the developing world or coastal communities in the developing world, there are going to be major challenges, and that can result in some very disturbing scenarios of large numbers of refugees and so forth, and the political challenges that come along with that, in addition to the disruption of people's lives and the loss of urban communities.
And just give us an idea, in this country alone, Ben, the amount of people that live on a coastline. We often hear these stories of San Francisco, New York, Miami, New Orleans. These are the flashpoint areas that people know are vulnerable cities as the climate shifts. But it's not so simple, is it?
That's right. There are a lot of smaller cities and cities that aren't that sort of visible marquee examples. Of course, both New Orleans and New York took direct hits from huge storms, and that really was very important for us as a nation to start to come to grips with what we're facing. But those aren't the only places that are going to be facing these challenges. And in fact, a lot of rural communities and a lot of smaller cities are facing these issues as well. I mean, places like the Outer Banks of North Carolina, where you have coastal roadways repeatedly being washed away on some of these barrier islands, and we come to a debate about how we should be rebuilding. Are we trying to replicate what was lost? How many times do we rebuild the same thing if it's in harm's way? From a distance, it's easy maybe to say that, well, let's go ahead and move things. But if that's your community, if that's your road, it's a very, very challenging problem. So we're going to have to develop not only tools for how to protect these places when we choose to do so, but we also need to develop tools for how we make decisions about where we hold the line versus where we retreat, which communities are quote unquote worth saving. I mean, these are very thorny questions, and they have, you know, major equity and social justice implications. And they're going to become much more common in the decades to come.
It's a fascinating topic. And if people want to learn more, they can go to spur.org/oceanbeach. Ben Grant, the Urban Design and Policy Director at Spur, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Sway the future to the past and find what will
endure. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Willis Jackson, Van Morrison, and the Grateful Dead. check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.